Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today knows a little more than most about how to stack the odds in one's favour. His career as a financial journalist has seen him write for publications including The New Yorker, Time, Fortune and Forbes. He's reported from all over the world and interviewed presidents, CEOs, billionaires and investors. His new book goes inside the lives of the world's most successful investors to find out what lessons they have to teach us on investing and beyond. William Green, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be here with you.
William, it's really interesting for me to talk to you because I think that the kind of work that you do, writing primarily about business, is a very different skill set from most of the writers that I speak to who are writing fiction or even non-fiction, but not in a, I want to say, businessy way, that giving it the technological term, of course.
Yeah, and I felt kind of sheepish about writing about this stuff because I studied English literature at Oxford and I thought I was going to come out and be a famous novelist. And then much to my surprise, discovered that I got sucked into writing about business and investing and was shocked to discover how interesting it is. But I think for many years, I was slightly embarrassed about it. I thought, God, it's slightly tawdry and vulgar, the idea that I'm just writing about, you know, rich people. And then at a certain point, I let go and I thought, well, actually, it deals with a lot of the great themes of life. You have so much greed, so much vanity. You're dealing with the fact that the future is unknowable, and yet we have to make decisions about the future. The fact that everything is so uncertain. And you're also, for the great investors, they're having to bet money on the future. So there's actually, there are real stakes involved. There's skin in the game. So when they're wrong, they actually really pay a price. And so there's a kind of inherent drama in it that I think makes for great storytelling. And then also because most people writing about the markets and investing in business are not really into literature and great storytelling, it struck me that there was a kind of void there, that if you actually were interested in personalities, in great characters, in these sort of slightly eccentric people that I tend to write about, there was actually a lot of scope for great storytelling.
So in fact, it would be erroneous to say that business writing is something completely different because it is all about storytelling.
Exactly. And the characters are fascinating. It's this, I think this is what captivated me fairly early on. And initially, I just wanted to make money myself without getting my hands dirty and having to work too hard. And so I thought, wow, this is a great game. If you learn to think well, you can make money without having to stack shelves or farm or do anything onerous, like work for a boss you dislike. And because I'm slightly indolent by nature, I thought that sounded fantastic. But then once I started actually to hang out with these people and interview them, I realized the best of the investors are real iconoclasts. They're these very open-minded, pragmatic, almost, I would say, practical philosophers. Because as I was saying, they're dealing with these questions like the fact that everything changes, everything is impermanent, nothing stays the same, the future is unknowable, and yet somehow you have to make decisions that position you well for this uncertain future. And so there's some aspect of game playing, of practical philosophy, and of thinking better that I think it draws a certain type of weird, interesting, curious character. And I just happen to find these people kind of fascinating. And I think for me also, I started to realize a few years ago that they're not dissimilar to writers in a sense that, as a writer, I always feel like I've been something of an outsider and I've been sort of peering through the window with my nose up against the glass, trying to figure out how the world works. And the best investors also are detaching themselves from the crowd and thinking in a very non-tribal way. They're constantly questioning what the herd is doing. And so there's something about this type of maverick, free-thinking, intellectual questioner of everything that I think resonated deeply for me. I'm sadly nowhere near as wealthy as they are, but I think intellectually there's a similarity actually between writers and great investors.
And we'll go on to how a lot of this book is beyond wealth, in fact. But first, I just wanted to delve a little bit into your own background because I cannot place your accent.
It's a bit confusing. Well, I grew up in London and then I had a sort of fairly conventional posh English education. I went to Eton, I went to Oxford. And then at a certain point in my early 20s, I moved to New York. And then I was in New York for about 12 years, then ended up moving to Hong Kong to work for Time magazine in Hong Kong, and then came back to London and now I've come back to New York. So it's a strange mishmash, my accent, I'm afraid.
And throughout that time, I mean, it's been 25 years worth of research and conducting interviews. What have you seen change within the business world in that time?
Gosh, very, I think one thing that I'm seeing now that's striking to me, just in the last year, that I think my book hopefully taps into, is I think there's a sense that there's a different way to do business, that the, for want of a better way of describing it, the Trumpian ethos of dog eat dog, zero sum game of somebody's got to get hurt for you to win. I think the pendulum is swinging away from that. I think that leaves people pretty cold and feeling pretty depleted. And part of what I'm trying to do with my book is write about people who, they provide an interesting counterexample where they see the possibility of a more enlightened type of capitalism, where they're more philanthropic, they're more philosophical. There's a sense of wanting to invest in businesses that are a win-win for their ecosystem. They're not just screwing their suppliers or cheating their clients. And I think that's interesting to me and kind of hopeful, that I see this relatively small minority of people who say, actually, this old way doesn't really work. You don't really want to be leaving a trail of destruction where you're just polluting, you're screwing all of your suppliers, you're leaving a trail of bankruptcies and lawsuits between you and your partners. And so that's part of my purpose in highlighting the people I highlight in my book, is that I do think they have a little bit more worldly wisdom, to use a phrase that John Maynard Keynes coined, I think.
Mm. So let's talk about the book then. It's called Richer, Wiser, Happier. Now, first of all, it's not your first book, is it?
No, I ghostwrote a whole bunch of books, which I'm always a little bit enigmatic about because I can't talk too openly about them. But I've one book that I very publicly collaborated on was with a mutual friend of ours, Guy Speer, who wrote a book called The Education of a Value Investor. So I helped him with that. Then I collaborated on a book with an extraordinary photographer, Michael O'Brien, who's one of the great portrait photographers, who had spent years taking photos, very, very beautiful, stark black and white photos, where he would get very up close to these great investors like Buffett and Buffett's partner, Charlie Munger, Irving Kahn, who died at the age of 109 a few years ago. And you would see them sort of staring directly in their eyes. And I wrote profiles that went with that book, with his photographs. And so in a way, that was a wonderful preparation for this current book, because I profiled something like 22 great investors in that book. And so when I started to write Richer, Wiser, Happier, I thought, okay, so who are the most interesting, most unusual, wisest investors that I've encountered, partly from that book, from the research that I did there, but also from interviews that I've done really over the last 25 years. And then I doubled down on that. So there are people who I ended up spending 5 days interviewing for this book, or 2 days. And I went to India for 5 days traveling with an extraordinary guy called Monish Pabrai, for example. So this book, in a sense, grows out of everything that I did with The Great Minds for Investing, that book of photography. It's sort of saying, these are the wisest, most interesting investors I've come across over the last 25 years. They have some degree of worldly wisdom. There's something they can teach us, not only about how to get rich, but actually about how to think better, and more controversially, actually about how to be wiser, how to live a happier life. And that was sort of the risk that I took in writing this book, was to say, no, honestly, you can learn something from these people about how to be happy, which I hope has proven to be true. But some people may have thought that was somewhat delusional on my part.
I think it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, you're essentially asking the questions, what skills billionaire investors possess? Are they transferable? And as you say, do they have anything to teach us besides making money? So in a way, it's almost a sort of self-help book. It does show us what it is that these people do and why they do it. Would you say that there's one thing that they all have in common?
I would say one of the most striking things about them is how profoundly rational they are. And so because they're these great pragmatists, they're taking ideas from anywhere they can find them. Most of us, we have our biases and prejudices, and then we try to to find evidence to fulfill what we were, to prove what we already believed to be the case. But because they're so pragmatic, because there's so much skin in the game, they don't really care about dogma being intellectually consistent. They just want to win. They just want to be right. And so they'll draw on ideas from many different disciplines that can help them. So if they discover from studying mindfulness or Buddhism that it's helpful for them to meditate because then their mind will be clearer so they can see better, they'll do that. If they discover that there's something from mathematics that could help them or biology, they'll draw from it. So to give you an example, someone like Charlie Munger, who's this 97-year-old polymathic genius who's been Buffett's partner for the last 40 years, he became obsessed with this idea from Carl Gustav Jacobi, who was this famous 19th century mathematician. And Jacobi said famously, invert, always invert. And so Munger looks at this idea and says, oh, okay, so how do I apply this idea of inversion in life? So he says, well, for example, if I want to be a great investor, let me first invert that and figure out, well, what would a terrible investor be? How can I be a terrible investor? Or if I want to have a happy life, let me first figure out how to have a miserable life. And so it's a kind of beautiful example of the ways in which these extraordinarily pragmatic people are just taking ideas from everywhere, mental models from everywhere, and saying, does it work? Is it helpful? And if it works, they'll use it. And so for me, they become a very interesting practical filter for how to live our lives. Mm. So they're thinking about things like how to manage their time, how to structure a calm environment in which to think better, what sort of people you want to hang out with, whether if you hang out with people who are worse than you, how's it going to affect you? So, well, let me hang out with people who are better than me, or how to handle stress and adversity. And so they become these great free-thinking pragmatists roaming through the world intellectually and figuring out, yeah, this thing works, this thing doesn't work, let me grab this one. And so I think that pragmatism and rationality in a way is the thing that connects all of them.
Mm. And of course, they've got to be brave enough to not hang out with anyone at all, if that's what it takes, to stray away from the crowd.
Yeah, I think that's very distinctive. The fact that there's something non-tribal about them. There's a very interesting Canadian investor, a guy called François Rochon, who I interviewed, who's also a great contemporary art collector. He uses his investing career to bankroll his real passion, which is collecting contemporary art. And he said to me that when you look at most people, we tend to be very tribal. I guess this makes sense in evolutionary terms, that if you're particularly in times of danger, like if you're being chased, if you're a gazelle or whatever, and you're being chased, you know, you find comfort in the herd, you find protection in the pack. And what he said to me is, then there are a few people who actually lack that tribal gene. And he said, those people just think for themselves. They don't actually care about following the crowd. And he said, if you lack the tribal gene, you have a tremendous advantage as an investor, because you don't feel like you just have to kind of pile into whatever overheated asset everybody else is piling into, or when everybody else is panicking because the market is crashing, like during the global financial crisis. You don't feel that sense of panic that you must pile out at the same time as everyone else. And curiously, he said to me that he thinks that writers and artists and some entrepreneurs actually also lack that tribal gene. And I that rings true to me. And I think, again, that may be one reason why I'm fascinated by the great investors, because I think naturally I actually lack the tribal gene. I find that when everyone else is really bullish and cheerful and the world is going well, I start to kind of quietly panic and worry. And then when everything starts to fall apart and everyone's miserable, I have this weird kind of joyfulness. And I'm like, oh, I told you so. I knew it was all going to fall apart. And then I start to be kind of happy and calm. And so I think there's just something sort of profoundly quirky and weird about my wiring. And so when I see these non-tribal investors, I recognize them in some way as sort of kindred spirit, albeit with a whole lot more yachts and planes than I have.
I mean, building on that, you talk about how to make wise decisions when nothing stays the same and the future is unknowable, like the financial crisis or indeed like coronavirus. And you talk about Howard Marks here.
Yeah, Howard is a remarkable person and very much a kind of practical philosopher, someone who's thinking about these deep questions about if everything changes and the future is unknowable, what can you do so that you're positioning yourself, not so that you're trying to predict the future, but so that you're positioning yourself to survive an unknowable future, an uncertain future. And so he was very deeply influenced, oddly, by this course that he did at Wharton in his youth, where he wanted actually to study art while he was at Wharton. And once they discovered that he was also studying finance, they threw him out of the class. And so he did a minor in Japanese studies. And while doing that, discovered this concept of mujo, which is this Japanese idea of impermanence that is very central to Zen Buddhist philosophy. And what's curious is this idea has totally and utterly informed his approach to markets. He basically says, well, if everything is changing, if the economy is not going to stay the same, if our jobs aren't going to stay the same, if the stock market goes up and down, nothing is predictable, then we need to accommodate ourselves to reality and we need to be humble about what we can and can't know. And so while most people are trying to predict the future, a lot of investors are thinking, wow, I'm going to try to jump in and out of the market. He starts from this much more humble position of saying, he says, I belong to the I don't know school of thought. And so part of what he's doing is he's saying, well, let me just look at the state of the world at the moment. Let me see how much risk other people are taking. Are they being reckless? So for example, right before the global financial crisis in 2008, 2009, he just looks around and he says, well, look at the lending standards, look at the crazy things that banks are doing where they'll lend to anyone without a job, without security. People are being reckless. And so he says, instead of trying to predict the future, I'm trying to predict the present. So he says, I look around and I see in this kind of intuitive way how people are behaving, how risk is being priced. And then he said, I adjust and accommodate myself to those circumstances. Mm. And so he says, instead of trying to predict the future, it's as if you're driving in very icy conditions. And you say, well, so if it's icy and it's foggy, let me drive a little more carefully. And so I find something very elegant about the connection between Zen Buddhist philosophy and the way you would approach investing and the way you would approach any decision. And he would say, well, partly what you want to do is build an unfragile life and an unfragile portfolio that's not going to collapse even in dire circumstances because we don't know what's going to happen. Mm. So live within your means, don't spend too much, avoid crazy amounts of debt, and don't fool yourself into thinking that you can predict the future when, as we've seen from COVID, he said, sometimes it's not just that we don't know what will happen. He said, sometimes we don't even know what could happen.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, speaking of COVID, there is an enormous backlash at the moment from people who have been very badly affected, who are very, very angry about the very small percent of people that have made huge amounts of money during this crisis. And people whose bank accounts, whose current accounts could, you know, fund entire countries. And a lot of feeling about, I don't know, the venality of investors and just the way that money continues to be made when everybody or many people are absolutely going to the wall. And I wonder how the investors themselves feel about that.
Yeah, On the whole, this is a very idiosyncratic book, and I've tended to focus on people who are not just rapacious billionaires, who just have a talent for making money and don't really care about society and don't care about how they make the money. I interviewed a bunch of those people, and I ended up, once I started writing about them, I felt almost like the body was rejecting this alien limb, you know, that this organ that kind of made the whole body kind of start to fall apart. And I just stopped writing about them. And so I would say, on the whole, the people that I'm writing about have a sense of wanting to have an impact on society, realizing how fortunate they are, how unfair the structure is, realizing that in some ways they have this strange mutant skill of being able to value an asset and buying it for less than it's worth, and that's not a hugely socially redeeming thing. And so they're trying to use the money to make a difference in society. And so the first chapter that I write is about this guy, Monish Pabrai, who's very remarkable, who launched a game basically in, I think, 1994, where he decided, well, I'm going to try to turn $1 million into $1 billion over 30 years by averaging 26% a year in my returns. But basically along the way, he's educated thousands and thousands of extremely intelligent Indian kids who he often from families of untouchables and people who were discriminated against for centuries. And he's taking these very high IQ kids and giving them free education so that they can take the test to get into the Indian Institutes of Technology, which is the equivalent of something like MIT. And for something like $2,500 per kid, he's able to drag an extraordinary number of children out of poverty. And so he's in some ways a perfect example of what I'm trying to write about. Somebody who says, yeah, I'm brilliant at playing this game, but I also plan by the time I'm done to have nothing left. Basically, he thinks by the time he's done, he'll leave a little bit of money to his two daughters, just enough so that they can do what they want to do, but not enough so that they'll do nothing, which is an idea that he took from Warren Buffett. But basically, all of the money will go to lifting people out of poverty.
And in your last chapter, you talk about beyond rich and how really there is much more to it than just making money, and more that we can learn from these people than just the finance side of it. And one of the people you highlight is Arnold Vandenberg. I wonder if you could tell us about him.
Yeah, Arnold I describe as probably the most, probably the single greatest role model of anyone I've encountered in the investing world. And I've said to him, you're not the most successful investor I've ever met, but I think you're the most successful human being I've ever met in the investment world. And part of the reason is that Arnold, unlike a lot of these great investors, was dealt the worst possible hand. Many of them started off, they went to Harvard Business School, Wharton, came from loving families, secure backgrounds. Arnold was born in 1939 on the same street basically as Anne Frank, and spent the first couple of years in hiding because he was a Jewish kid. He was hidden behind the wall of some Christian friends of his parents in Amsterdam. And then at a certain point, they basically decided, well, look, if Arnold or his brother Sigmund cry when the Nazis come and search this house, we're all going to get killed. They'll send the kids to Auschwitz and they'll be the first to get killed. And so his parents took this desperate gamble and said that they basically got in touch with people in the underground. And a girl of about 17 who didn't know Arnold's family smuggled him out of this house where he was in hiding, really a risk to her own life and her entire family, and took him to an orphanage in the countryside where he grew up, really eating nothing, hidden away. I mean, he said to me, by the time he left at the age of six, he said he barely could walk. He was basically shuffling along on his knees. And so he was malnourished, did terribly at school. They thought that basically he had brain damage because he was so malnourished. And so this is a guy who started with the worst possible hand and yet somehow has become an extremely successful investor, but much more important, an extraordinary human being, very loving, very kind, incredible relationship with his family. Everywhere you go, you find people who tell you about ways in which Arnold has helped them. And for me, Arnold was a wonderful example of what actually constitutes a successful and truly abundant life. He's someone who he's used the money, he's used his success to lift up countless people. And at the same time, what's remarkable to me is that he took control of his inner life. He started off as someone who was full of rage, full of resentment against the Nazis, against Germans. His first wife left him for another man, and so he was full of resentment and hatred for her. And he's just transformed himself over the years into this extraordinarily kind and loving person. And so it got to a couple of issues for me, one of which is that a successful life has to involve some sort of sharing, some sort of purpose beyond our own ego. We have to do something to help other people, actually, because it's going to make us happier and it makes the world better. But also, you have to take control of your inner landscape, that if you don't have some degree of equanimity, of peace of mind, all of the money in the world, all of the yachts, all of the planes are worthless. And here's Arnold, who doesn't have a yacht, doesn't have a plane, doesn't care about it, was embarrassed when his wife got him a really nice car because he preferred to drive, you know, his crappy 13-year-old car. And there's no pretense, there's no ostentatiousness. But he said to me, I'm the richest person in the world. And part of what I'm trying to do in that last section of the book is to explain what true wealth is, what you see from a life like that in terms of his behavior, the delight that he takes in helping other people. And that in a sense, there's something really enlightened about that, that it turns out to have made him much happier as well. And I think if he had just been focused on you know, having more toys and baubles and a bigger house, and it wouldn't have made him happier. So there's something kind of really encouraging about that. It makes you realize that what makes for a great life tends to be not vast wealth. It's really basic stuff like good relationships. And there's another great investor, Ed Thorpe, who I describe as the greatest game player in the history of investing. And he said to me, look, at the end of the day, he said, a happy life is really determined by who you spend your time with. And so relationships turn out to be the most important thing of all. And there's something kind of heartening about that if you interview some of the richest people in the world, what you discover is, yeah, no, it's not the yachts and planes that matter. It's whether you're getting on with your wife and kids or your friends or your partner.
William, that is so interesting. And the book, Richer, Wiser, Happier, is really a piece of work that can help us all, I believe. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you. It's been lovely chatting with you.
William Green, Richer, Wiser, Happier is published by Scribner. It's out now. And you've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.